Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Matt Cantor. Matt gave a talk for us last year on a very different topic. He was a fascinating man. When I met him, we had this long conversation. I knew right away when I started doing this that I'd love to get him up in front of a bunch of people to talk. He doesn't shy away from topics which other people shy away from. So his topic tonight is Capitalism, a Condition of an Immature Social Psychology. And only in San Francisco would we sell out that kind of an audience. So welcome, Matt Cantor.
Hey, George. Well, there is actually a lot of light here. Good. Thank you so much. I had such a great time when I first met George, and I'm just amazed that a person who has one stated profession has published a dozen books on other on areas that he doesn't have any sort of official, diplomas for, or other kinds of background for, and I think it just shows that we don't have to be, you don't have to have a degree in something to get interested in it. We can all take interest in pretty much anything we want, and somebody's valued expertise in something isn't necessarily the same as the diploma that they have. One thing, Niles earlier for suggesting that if this isn't working out so well, I could do an interpretational dance on capitalism. So, halfway through, if it's not going well, I'll switch to that. First off, this is unlike last year, where I spoke for about 20 minutes, I couldn't rein it in. So this is probably a little closer to a half hour. There should still be plenty of time for us to engage in some debate on this issue. I will confess before I start to read my piece, elements of this might seem like a sermon because I'm passionate about it. So I apologize for that in advance. Starting in the year 2000, a pair of Pennsylvania judges, Mark Civarella and Michael Conahan, engaged in a conspiracy to defund and close a local county-run juvenile detention facility and then fund a new private facility that was to be built by a company comically called Pennsylvania Child Care. Anybody know this story? Good. And its sister company, Western Pennsylvania Child Care. Civarella and Conahan had begun receiving FedEx boxes full of cash early on for employing their political positions to gradually decrease funding and eventually close the county-run detention facility. The money they received came from contractors who intended to build and populate the new facility. Once the new facility had been built, the judges began packing one by one over 6,000 youths into these facilities. Pardon me, there's more than one. Many over the objections of their parole officers. The judges were found guilty of taking $2.6 million in bribes for playing their part in this Dickinsonian ploy that seems to jump right off the pages of Oliver Twist. Many of the cases were ones in which there was no representation for these young people. Many were heard in under a minute, and many involved infractions on the order of the youths having blogged with poorly chosen words about their teachers at school. Some were incarcerated for months over disorderly behavior such as might typically lead a child to be grounded or temporarily suspended from school. It's really quite shocking. Subsequent to the trials held by these two judges, the majority of these young people have been released, demonstrating the vast majority of these incarcerations were engineered for personal gain and not at all justified. What are the factors that allow such injustice, and how rare is this really? Who is at fault? Is it Civarella and Conahan? Do we have a system designed to depend on the ethics of the individual, or do we build institutions that invite such malfeasance? Clearly, when jails are built by private for-profit entities, such as is increasingly the case in the U.S., and when these private companies have enormous wealth and influence, it's hard to control what leverage these private entities may try to exert on the making and enforcement of laws. How much justice is really being doled out? Since the Reagan-era so-called war on drugs began, the percentage of our prison population guilty of nothing more than drug use or sales has soared to roughly 40%. 40% of the people in prisons today were guilty of drug charges of some sort. Are these people guilty of competing with mainstream drug and alcohol sales? Or are they, like our Pennsylvania youths, simply guilty of being a natural resource in an increasingly private and profitable system? The Corrections Corporation of America, currently trading on the New York Stock Exchange at about $24 a share, has a current total asset value of about $3 billion. CCA is only one of many such companies that now build and run our prisons. These corporations, like all private for-profit entities, seek to enrich themselves and their stockholders by any legal means necessary, and one of these methods is by lobbying, literally giving money to those who make our laws and asking that the laws that put people in prison be made tougher so as to increase their share of business. In this way, we can see that the case of Conahan and Civarella is not actually unusual. The only difference is the legality. Employees of CCA, along with 2,000 state legislators and 250 citizens, belong to ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC lobbyists are actively engaged in criminal justice discussions in the U.S. Congress as well as in various state legislatures. When private groups made up of profit makers form coalitions with members of our government is less neutral and less able to represent the concerns of all persons equally, especially when lots of money changes hands. According to the Boston Phoenix, Corrections Corporation of America spent more than $2.7 million between 2006 and 2008 lobbying for stricter laws that will put more people in jail and keep them there longer. CCA isn't interested in greater justice or a safer community. They're interested in bigger profits. Corrections Corporation of America also spent nearly $15 million lobbying the Department of Homeland Security, our Immigration Enforcement Department, the Office of Management and Budget, the Bureau of Prisons, and Congress between 2003 and last year. The point of this talk about the Pennsylvania case, the private prison industry, and trade groups such as ALEC is to begin to identify what's wrong with capitalism, so far as we can adequately define it. No doubt, capitalism is hard to define, but I think we can agree that it's a system in which profit-making is the primary driving force behind most functions. If there's no money to be made in it, capitalism isn't doing it, and some other motivations have to be tapped. There is enough humanity functioning in the society so that many functions that don't make much money are still upheld, but these seem to be faltering, if not crumbling, in many parts of our society today. Surely there are positive things that have come from capitalism, since the making of profit is a formidable encouragement for people to produce better goods and services of all sorts, though I'm certain it can always be successfully argued that controls on profit and regulation on how we do business still leaves plenty of motivation and helps to make sure that personal desire doesn't allow for the wrong things to occur. The Pennsylvania case, I'm sure you'll agree, is just such an example. I hope you'll also agree that the existence of groups such as ALEC are also where things are going wrong and should be abolished along with all forms of graft and influence peddling. If we consider ourselves to be a democratic nation, we can't tolerate it any longer. What I intend to show are a series of examples of where other things go wrong and how other less capitalistic nations get it better than we have it now. Some of these have to do with our level of happiness, our physical health, and the system that helps us maintain it. Many of the examples I will use relate to levels of equality. Why equality? My central argument against capitalism and why I believe it represents an immature social psychology is that it leads us away from what we really want. What do we want? Most of us want to be healthy and happy and live long lives in a peaceful world. The examples I will provide show that more capitalistic nations have less of these things and less capitalistic nations have more of them. The notions of sharing and fairness are perhaps our most common social agreement. These are the first things we teach our children when we bring them together in places of learning or social gatherings. In fact, we insist that children share and treat each other fairly. This applies to food, toys, space, the sharing of friends, etc., virtually anything. We tend to agree across virtually all language and cultural boundaries that it is critical, essential, that we share what we have and that we make sure that no one's basic needs gets ignored. If one child in a nursery school room were to gather up all the sandwiches at the start of the lunch and pour all the cups of juice into their own jug, we would certainly put a stop to that right away, and there would ensue much talk about how we don't do that. We would hear how every child deserves their share and that hoarding is wrong. Further, if one child invented a game, some sort of gamble, or quiz that deprived even one child of their lunch, or their shirt, or a precious toy, we would again certainly have some sort of parent-teacher conference on the subject and how greater skill on the part of one child did not warrant and would not be allowed to deprive another of their basic needs or of a personal possession. In other words, at some very primal level, we understand the need to respect and enforce the basic rights of everyone around us, even of strangers. Why aren't we able to see the unacceptable nature of these inequities where adults are concerned? Is it a blindness of some sort? Are there presumptions that we have about rich people, poor people, Finnish people, or Arabic people that allow us to believe that some are more deserving than others? Clearly, this is the case. Nonetheless, if you were in a room with any of these people as infants, you would certainly make sure they were adequately fed, clothed, and treated. In other words, treated fairly and respectfully, if not lovingly. Perhaps this teaches us something about borders. Borders of all kinds allow us to accept the notion that the rules are different over there, that the people over there are different, that perhaps they are more or less deserving. Why do we not instead see all people everywhere as equally deserving and part of the same community we belong to? There is some sort of suspension of reality that we must be practicing in order to continue along the path we're on, the path of inequity, the path that defies democracy. In my opinion, capitalism in its current form cannot exist without this forced blindness, this avoidance of our reality. In other words, we're all, to some degree, in denial of our circumstances, a little bit crazy. Therefore, capitalism should be abandoned simply because it doesn't give us what we want. It may be capable of providing enormous wealth for a small number of winners, but the data shows that even if these few are our primary concern, they aren't getting what they really want. I'm going to say a lot more about that. Most of the rich don't feel rich, and they aren't the happiest people. What is at odds between capitalism and equality? Well, regardless of what one might say about the ability of every person in the society to obtain wealth, profit-making never works out that way. Invariably, for-profit systems end up aggregating wealth in highly disproportionate ways. Systems that attempt to counter this and rebalance the distribution of goods and services, such as socialist economies, never lack profit motives completely, but through regulation and administration, help to make sure that the needs of every person are met to some degree. In fact, if we do that here, we do that here, though we're doing it less and less each day to our evident detriment. Our schools are getting worse. Our roads and bridges are crumbling, and we have nearly one-sixth of our population unable to obtain reasonable access to health care. As we look across borders, we can see that poorer nations than ours have high-speed rail, single-payer health care for all, higher levels of education, and lower rates of obesity, violence, and teen pregnancy. I'll get very specific about these later on. Now to the data. Statistics, particularly those regarding race and incarceration, strongly suggest that we're often throwing people in jail simply because they're the wrong color. Though they comprise only 12.4% of the population, black Americans represent over 38% of our prison population. The private prison industry isn't new to the U.S. We've been privatizing all sorts of things that used to be the sacred domain of disinterested governmental bodies for decades now. Pardon me for the little shift there. And this would appear to be the capitalistic trend. The prison industry in America is rapidly becoming a very big business. According to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, over 7 million people were on probation, in jail, prison, or on parole in 2009, over 3% of the adults in the United States. 2.3 million were incarcerated in the United States in U.S. prisons and jails. At an incarceration rate of 748 inmates per 100,000, or 0.75%, the U.S. has the highest documented prison and jail population in the world. Even Rwanda can't touch us with a rate of 545 per 100,000. And if we seem unjust compared with Rwanda, I wonder if we are who we think we as Americans really are. How successful is capitalism when this is the result? Finland and Japan have rates of roughly 60 per 100,000, less than one-tenth of ours. Are these outlaw nations unable to put their criminals in jail? That might be more easily argued with the low numbers in Haiti or Sierra Leone, but it's clear that it's just not important enough. It's not good business, and there are better things that these people can do with their time and money. Increasingly, U.S. prisons are workplaces for large corporations to find a workforce. Since these same corporations give money to senators, congressmen, and local lawmakers, how do we prevent the slow and, I would argue, inevitable slide into a world of betas and gammas, a world in which those who pull the strings have much to gain by putting more and more of us in and keeping us in prison complexes? We live in a country and a world in which there is tremendous inequity. As the senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, pointed out in a recent plea to Congress to not reinstate the Bush-era tax cuts, the richest 1% of our country made more money in 2010 than the entire bottom 50%. In other words, a group of about 3 million made more money than another group of 150 million. Further, the richest 400 persons in the U.S. hold more wealth than that same group of 150 million people, who live largely from one paycheck to the next. And this isn't just an American problem. According to a study by the World Institute for Development Economics Research, in the year 2000, the world's richest 1% owned 40% of global assets. More shocking, in that same year, the three richest people in the world possessed greater assets than the lowest 48 nations combined. Draw a breath. Yet, we seem to accept this as a societal norm, as an inevitability, or even the proper state for humanity. Why? Like winning a lottery of several million dollars, most of us view enormous wealth as both personally achievable and a fulfilling goal, when the evidence would tend to argue the opposing position. Even when people do win lotteries, research suggests that the results, more often than not, demonstrate that money isn't what we really wanted or need. Economists at the Universities of Kentucky, Pittsburgh, and Vanderbilt University asked the following question. What happens when individuals in financial trouble are given large lump sums? So they collected data from nearly 35,000 winners of up to $150,000. In Florida's Fantasy Five lottery from 1993 to 2002, and cross-referenced this information with state bankruptcy records. Their findings, published last fall in the Review of Economics and Statistics, show that a big lottery score does little to reduce the likelihood of bankruptcy. More than 1,900 winners went bankrupt within 5 years, and that number implies that 1% of Florida lottery players, winners and losers, go bankrupt in any given year, about double the rate for the broader population during the study period. So if you want to go bankrupt, win the lottery. Big lottery winners, those awarded $50,000 to $150,000, were half as likely as small lottery winners to go bankrupt, in other words, the same as the rest of the population, but within two years of their score, but just as likely to go bankrupt 3 to 5 years after. The results show that giving $50,000 to $150,000 to people only postponed bankruptcy, the authors concluded. We act as if and vote as if we will one day be the possessor of great wealth and power and the ability to lord over our own kingdoms. I would argue that much of the conservative political platform is based on this idea that you and I, we're going to be the rich one. We're going to be the one on TV. We'll be Lady Gaga. No, I'm not going to be Lady Gaga. If it were not for this popular fantasy, each successive vote by our Congress for the rich to pay less taxes and for the bottom to bear more and more of the weight of sustaining the society would surely result in a revolt on some part of that 150 million people at the bottom. We're all walking around a little bit asleep, or drugged, or drunk, or high on food, TV, movies, or whatever you've got. The epidemiologist Richard Wilkinson and his partner Kate Pickett of the Equality Trust, a sociological think tank, have used statistical data to look at global inequality. Their research shows that nations that have higher internal equality have lower rates of mental illness, obesity, drug abuse, teen pregnancy, imprisonment, and violence. They also have improved child well-being, physical health, and social mobility. In the U.S., where income equality is high, the homicide rate is roughly 65 per million. In Japan, where economic inequality is low, the homicide rate is roughly 5 per million, less than one-tenth. Norway, Denmark, Belgium, and Austria are all under 10 million and have similarly low levels of economic inequality. Obesity also tracks with economic inequality, so if you want to lose weight, move away from the United States. Again, Japan's rate of obesity is about one-fifteenth of ours. In the U.S., where nearly one-third of us are obese today, Sweden and Norway track around 10% obesity, despite the cold climate, and have lower economic inequality. The U.K. has relatively high inequality, making them a good political partner when we need them, and are running about 23% obesity. Interestingly, they've caught the fast food bug from us, with KFC, Burger King, and McDonald's available in many British cities. Their data also reaffirms our former comments on rates of imprisonment, but adds the cross-index of income inequality. Again, Japan bottoms out the list at about 40 per 100,000 citizens imprisoned, and nearby on the graph we find Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Denmark. The U.S. and Singapore top the list, with the U.S. taking the prize with over 700 per 100,000 imprisoned, or close to 1%. Drug abuse, while correlating somewhat less precisely with income inequality, still makes a convincing graph with the U.S. near the top, along with New Zealand and the U.K. Australia spikes a bit higher than the rest, but it's still a state with relatively high economic inequality. Mental health is nearly a straight-line graph, with the U.S. leading a sample of 12 developed nations in both mental illness and economic inequality, with over 25% of our population being identified with some sort of mental illness. So I'd like a quarter of you to step over into the corner right now. Japan and Germany, our World War II enemies, are quite a bit saner than us, with under 10% each, along with Spain and Italy. Why are we so crazy? Additionally, to their credit, the Scandinavian countries top the list for child well-being, along with Switzerland and Spain. The UK, New Zealand, and Israel bottomed the list. The US, for a change, wasn't the worst, but given our wealth, let's not send out any press releases. We were at the top of the list of 22 developed nations for infant deaths, 1,000 per 1,000 live births, and by no small margin. Only Singapore exceeds us in economic inequality on this list. And according to the World Health Organization, we spend more on medical care per person than any nation in the world. How do we spend this much money on health care and have such a high infant mortality rate? What's wrong? Lastly, and I believe this is significant, social mobility tracked closely with economic equality. This means that societies that already have less emphasis on wealth, or at least less of an exclusive wealthy class, allow for persons who did have familial, who didn't have familial success to rise in the social strata and obtain improved circumstances for themselves. Conversely, it means that where there are haves and have-nots, you'd best get to like where you are, because you're not going to go anywhere from there. You're going to stay where you are. Researchers at the London School of Economics looked at social mobility in 8 countries in the U.S. and Europe to arrive at this data. If peace is part of what we want to have in the world and our lives personally, and what beauty pageant winner doesn't want world peace, we might want to take a close look at the GPI, or Global Peace Index. The GPI is the product of the Institute for Economics and Peace. Data is gathered by an international panel of experts and collated by the Economist Intelligence Unit, now in its 65th year. That's the same as the Economist magazine. They have a research institute that's part of what they are. Some of the leading indicators that the GPI looked at included numbers of internal and external wars fought, estimated deaths due to external wars, estimated deaths due to internal wars, level of distrust in other citizens, and number of homicides. It's interesting who ends up near the top of the list, given our previous analysis of economic equality. Excepting New Zealand, 9 of the top 10 will sound familiar as being states identified by the Equity Trust as having the highest economic equality. Iceland, Japan, Austria, Norway, Ireland, Denmark, Luxembourg, Finland, and Sweden. Clearly, equality breeds peacefulness. And why not? When you can look around you and see that others near you and in your community are okay, it's less scary. It's also less sad. One also need not guard one's sandwich or one's factory quite so closely. Equality is good for business, and it's good for the heart. It is, however, bad for the war business, and there is little doubt that one of the reasons that the U.S. is where it is on the Global Peace Index, 85th, on the Happy Planet Index, a gauging of happiness across cultures that I'll cover later, where we rank a sorry 114th, and on the various metrics of the Equality Trust, very low across the board, is that we devote so much of our creativity and focus to killing or preparing to kill. I think it's part of why we're crazy. It's also very expensive, costing us in the U.S. far more than a half of our GDP if you factor in all the costs associated with military police, border maintenance, weapons manufacture, etc. Further, I would argue that it makes us less sane. It is quite possible that part of the reason that mental illness is so much higher in the United States and other places where peacefulness ranks low is that our posture of aggression and preparedness to kill maligns our mental states. I would also argue that living with 10,000 nuclear weapons in the U.S. makes us kind of crazy. It certainly should identify us as being crazy. What sort of nutcase would live with hundreds of armed explosives in their house? You know, we go looking for those people, right? It's been 46 years since the Moynihan Report, written by then sociologist and later U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, was released in 1965. This is a crowd where you probably know who that fellow is. How many people remember Daniel Patrick Moynihan? How many people remember the study? Right. This report, focusing on the black family in America, showed that lack of employment was the primary cause in the breakdown of the family, and that when men have jobs, the focus was on men, but the effects on women can be surmised, families remain intact. This means children grow up without the disabling trauma and stigma of being fatherless. Those children are more likely to succeed in school and in life and contribute to the workforce and the world of their peers. They are far less likely to be jobless, drug addicted, and incarcerated. These individuals then contribute rather than tax the system. The same sort of argument is easily made about the availability of education. If educational resources are provided to all places in the globe at an equal level, how much less emotional dissociation might we see? Of course, every culture will not immediately accept the collective notion of education, but this is a minor long-range problem that will fix itself if resources are offered. Greg Mortensen, anybody know Greg Mortensen's work? Great. The natural follow-up to this. Greg Mortensen's work in Pakistan and Afghanistan over the last decade has shown us that it is possible to build schools even in places where there's tremendous hostility and mistrust towards the West. To date, Mortensen and company have built 171 schools and have provided education to over 64,000 Afghani and Pakistani children, including, most astonishingly, 54,000 girls. They don't usually allow that. So that can change. If statistics on education and life trajectory are any indication of the long-range effects of this work, it's likely that these girls will have children later, will raise better-educated children, will live longer, will make more money, and will not be involved in warfare. They will add to their societies and demand increased democracy. Everybody shares a desire to make things better for themselves and their progeny. Everybody. The entirely justifiable anger and mistrust exhibited by some cultures on this planet towards Western notions of development need only be met with kindness and patience and generosity in order to be swiftly swept away. Our treatment of the Muslim culture is the first example that comes to mind, but there are plenty of others. This is my favorite part. The Happy Planet Index, or HPI, is an index of human well-being and environmental impact and is the product of the New Economic Foundation. As you might expect, the results didn't meet the popular notion that Americans or Japanese or French were the happiest. Who were the happiest? Can you guess?
Norway.
No, they're not. Costa Rica. The woman wins the prize. There's actually number one. So, in fact, in 2009, the U.S. ranked 114th. We're not very happy. We're the wealthiest, and we're not that happy. Costa Rica topped the list. Next to them was the Dominican Republic, Guatemala, and Vietnam was number five. Apparently, we didn't bomb them well enough. They're still happy. The per capita GDP, PPP, or purchasing power parity, so we can adjust GDP according to the ability of people to buy in their own local markets. So GDP isn't the whole answer. You want to look for GDP, PPP. For Costa Rica, is about $10,500 a year. The Dominican Republic is $8,600 a year. Again, they're adjusting up for us because their goods are cheap. In fact, these numbers are lower. Jamaica, third on the list, was $8,700, and Guatemala was $4,800. The actual unadjusted per capita for Guatemala was $2,600, or nearly 1/20 of the American median. Take a minute and just think about that. They're happy. They're really happy, and they don't have a lot of money. More than 4 out of 10 American millionaires say they do not feel rich. Indeed, many would need to have at least $7.5 million, I don't know where they came up with that figure, in order to feel rich, according to a Fidelity Investment Survey. The message is that money, at least the way we think of money, isn't what we're really looking for. We're trapped in a game, perpetuated by those who play on our own lack of emotional evolution. I have no criticism for those who take advantage of us any more than I do for a flesh-eating bacterium or a cancer cell. They're just doing what they're built to do. You don't hate a giant boulder for having great mass as it crushes you. That's just what giant boulders do if you get in their way. Let's all get out of the way. Similarly, we can't evolve by cutting off the heads of the elite. That's been tried, right? We win the way the people of Egypt recently won. Yay for the Egypt! By freeing our minds and by bravely standing up for our beliefs, regardless of past precedent. The U.S. is about as old as capitalism itself, just 200 or 300 years old. There's no reason why we can't say no to the stock market, the derivatives market, and the process of lobbyists buying senators and congresspeople. There was a time before the Citizens United case. Everybody know Citizens United? Good. Decided that the sky was purple when money paid to political officials was called graft and treated with excoriation and the occasional tarring and feathering. If we all gather on our own Tahrir squares, it can change overnight. You know, I actually have more to read, but that's going to be enough because we need time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt. Those of you who know my approach to these things, I think it's very, very important to kind of analyze it from a personality point of view. One of the things that you, of course, in your title is that it's an immature psychology. The question is, you know, if we had extremely mature psychologies, we wouldn't need a lot of rules. We wouldn't need a lot. So I think partially we have immature psychology. We need different rules. And I think the incentives in any kind of organization or any kind of institution, whatever it's called, are crucial. So one of the things that I'd like to know about is, you said about the mental illness in America. Mm. There's a nice case in Arkansas when they changed the rule. They added an extra $50 a month for families on welfare whose children were identified as slow learners. And so it was about 3 years later, and one-third of the children that were entering kindergarten had already been identified as slow learners because there was an extra $50 a month. And so, whether there's mental illness or not is a big question. It's a question of what are our incentives and which way are we going and how are we doing these things. So the thing that I wanted to ask about first is how would you define maturity versus immaturity?
Well, I think, at least let's stick with the area that I've talked about, because I think I actually gave, a very specific sort of answer to that, and that's with regards to our ability to share with other people. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I think, necessarily is empathy. I think a more evolved individual can experience what's going on in another person over there. And naturally, when we're children, we're thinking about ourselves. When we're unevolved, we can't imagine what it's like for the person on the other side. And I contend that there aren't enough of us who have evolved to the place where we can see somebody in another country, of another color, in another language, as deserving as we of life and, the things that make that up.
And those of us who haven't persuaded the rest to change the rules yet. And I would say my definition of maturity is pretty simple. My definition of maturity is that you recognize that you're one of 7 billion rather than the center of the universe. I think that's basically what it is. And if you look at most children, they are the center of the universe, and it is something that you... But in addition to this, you talked about the children. I thought it was a great idea that one child would collect all the cupcakes and everything and then all the drinks. All the work that's done in schools, even with children in public schools and I'm sure other, private schools too, even with children from families whose parents are really in favor of this kind of an idea, it takes a long time, and middle school does not count. you're the center of the universe when you're in middle school, no matter how much education you have, except for just, less than 1% of the population. So given that circumstance, and given how many adults do get out of it, what methodology or what institutional setups... And my bias is not for capitalism or socialism or any other form of ism right now. Mm-hmm. It's how much freedom is there in the institution. Because if you say, for example, you've got the three, one of your statistics was just great, that the three biggest billionaires in the world have more resources at their command than 48 countries. Okay. However, if you had all communists, now I spent 1973, the summer of 73, in the Soviet Union under Brezhnev's rule. So, and I went on purpose to try to see what it was actually like. But if you just counted the governments, all the government leaders, all the dictators in Africa and other places, a lot of them are functionally billionaires as well because they're in control of even more assets than our billionaires.
Oh, yeah.
And so they make the decisions institutionally. And so I don't draw a distinction between the two so much. As I say, this is who controls the assets and how can you decentralize them?
The names are a problem. We don't have good definitions for what we're really talking about. We've allowed the business community to draw a lot of these boundaries and to give a lot of things names. We need new terminology for this. And I think we need to talk about equality, not equality versus inequality.
I've mentioned this before a couple times, but when the Soviet Union was going down, since I had studied it, that was my area of study in college and everything, and I had followed it very carefully, when it was going down, I wrote a letter to Gorbachev, and I said, you really are missing an opportunity here by just saying, we're done. You should go to the United Nations and give a speech. You should say, okay, we were extremists with this idea, and it doesn't work because, the Stalins of this world are going to take over centralized power, and they're going to use it the way they want to, and so on and so forth. He said, but, the West has responded to us by creating a social safety net. This is from the 30s and so on. It was the response to communism and that alternative. Because the population of the planet, the population of every culture with varying degrees of percentages, is a certain number of entrepreneurs, between 5 and 10%. That's the way they get their pleasure. There's a certain amount of people who really require a large amount of security in their system in order to feel comfortable, and they need to be told what to do and given good work so that they feel important. And that's another group. And then there's there's a whole bunch of different personalities, all looking for happiness, peace, and so on, but all with different personalities in order to... So how do you organize it? And by accident, the capitalistic West, in responding to the threat of communism, created a system that's partially socialistic, partially capitalistic, but we're just starting, and I don't think we have the incentives right at all, including the incentives that you talk about with the prisons. Great, great example of that.
I think it's simply evolved because whoever's got the best game, if you don't study the game carefully, whoever's got the best game starts to be in charge. They start to pull in most of the money, and they get to say what the rules are going to be. They get to influence what the rules are going to be. I don't think that we chose capitalism. I think it evolved this way, and it evolved because there are always clever people who are more busier trying to gather it all up for themselves, trying to gather up all the sandwiches.
Mark Twain made a comment about this at the time when socialism was first, Marx had just written his books. He said that if you divided all the money and wealth in the world equally, it would be in 3 years, it would be all back in the same hands that it had been in before.
Absolutely.
Okay. So if that's true, then we really need to work about on the incentives and the institutions and what's going on, because long term, how do you take the personalities who have the capacity to always get it back in their own hands and the next group of people who are very, very productive that are more interested in sharing, and the next group who don't think about any of these things, and which is the vast majority, but you want to make sure that they have a good life but not be too paternalistic about it and so on. It's a very, very difficult set of ideas. And now let's have questions from the audience to go back and forth on them.
Hi. This is not really a question. This is just a
go
comment to the things that you've been saying.
Sure.
I agree with everything that you've said, but I see some of that in a slightly different focus. The concept of capitalism, as we talked about, is not just one kind of capitalism. There are a lot of different variations, just like you indicated that communism was taken by Stalin and gone, off the deep end. I think this is what has happened now with capitalism. I'm referring to, I don't know if you're familiar with Naomi Klein's book, yes. The Shock Doctrine. If anybody hasn't read that, I would highly recommend you read it, because I think that she has set up that framework for being able to see exactly what is happening in our system now. And essentially what it is that the people who are following a particular type of capitalism, which is the free market capitalism, are just taking it for a ride. And it's been tried in other places, chaotically. The three pillars of that are privatize everything, deregulation, get rid of the unions. And one by one, all of this has now been happening here. And I think it's going to get worse, because this is where the people, the power structure, this is where they're coming from. So to add to what you were saying, people...
We've had more protesting against anti-unionization.
That's the thing.
Yes.
With all of the other stuff. But what I would like to just add here is that I think what has to happen is that people need to really understand what is happening with our economic system. You know, it's a very specific thing, and it's being driven, and you can see it all over. And I don't think it's a coincidence that our education system is going down the tubes, because it's easier to have people in the palm of your hand. They'll eat anything that you throw out as a soundbite, because they don't know how to think. They're not being educated. This is where it's really critical that we do.
Moneyed interests are making the decisions. The less value there is in us,
being well educated, and that's not, there are so many other prongs to this. Lots, and the news media is part of it. We should be constantly being educated well by the news media about all range of things, including what's actually going on. But of course, all the major news networks are owned by the same companies that manufacture weapons, that manufacture hamburgers, and everything else. So there's not much outside of that box. Luckily, we do have an internet, which is actually in a lot of trouble with the issues over net neutrality right now. Are people following that issue? It's actually incredibly important. important that we have the net be neutral so that organizations like Democracy Now! Can be seen on computers around the world. They will stop being available. All the alternative press will stop being available to most people if large companies have their way around that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's one other element, you know, to that. And I think this is an idea. First of all, as you said, it's only been going on for a couple hundred years, and so humanity takes time to get used to something. But I think that one of the great optimisms, you know, I mean, there's always concentration of power and then breaking it down. But one of the great optimistic things that's going on is that people are finally starting to say, you know, it's better to not just rule another country and not just, you know, be the dictator for the other country. It's maybe just better to trade with them. It's just too much trouble to be. It's true in our personal lives, too. You know, the paterfamilias used to just want to have total control over the family. You know, that's a lot of trouble. And, you know, it used to be that you wanted to have 50 wives. That's also a lot of trouble. At a certain point, you know, you begin to say, what is it, you know, that you want in your relationship to other people? Do you want to be the dictator or not? And I think as we get more used to decentralized power and more decision-making, the idea of power in itself is less attractive. Unfortunately, it'll take 1,000 years or something like that for that to really sink in as a personality trait. But that, I think, is a trend.
Yes.
And it's a positive trend that's going on.
It's a psychological problem. I mean, I really think that neurology, psychology, philosophy, medicine are where we're going to ultimately find the answers to this. We naturally go towards this sense of depravity. To give you just a bit of what I didn't get to in the end is, I mean, we all experience. We all tend to experience a sense of, you know, of neediness. And very wealthy people who are trying to gather up around them are just the same and perhaps, arguably, greater in that way, feeling that they must have more and must have more because they're terrified. If we can manage that and people can come into the world and live in the world without being traumatized and terrified and feel that there's such a thing as enough. What is enough?
Great question. Go ahead.
In 1987, there was a book written, The Closing of the American Mind, and I think that's what you're experiencing. The educational system has let the culture down for whatever reason, and without education, you don't get maturity, and you don't get the criteria that you're speaking to. You get greed, and so that's what we're money whores in America today, and because of that, we've turned into a nation of thieves. That's basically what we are. That's what all these checks and balances are about, because people are stealing because they can't earn.
I think that the loss of education, of the educational system, the crumbling of the educational system in the United States is really tragic and leads to a whole bunch of other dominoes falling down. I actually think that we get to this state before then. I think that we come into the world with neurological problems that make us want to gather up and distrust, and or kids are traumatized when they're really young and they're unable to get past that. And I think psychology is going to provide the really important answers.
One thing about what you said was fascinating. I did the Yukos-Sibneft oil deal merger in Russia in 2003. So my years are only 30 years on. In 2003. And what was fascinating to me was this was a deal that Khodorkovsky has been in jail ever since in Siberia because Putin didn't like what he did. When I was working on it, the Russian lawyer that was in charge, I came over just to oversee the deal, she said that they were not listening to our advice as a law firm about what they had to do to advise the shareholders in America about doing their due diligence, for those of you who are aware of that. So I had to talk to the CFO about it, and he took me into a room, and he said, you know, George, it's very simple. He said, we know that they have skeletons in their closet, and they know that we have skeletons in our closet, but we have a pretty good idea about how much oil is in the ground. And that's what we're basing this all on. So we don't want to tell them ours. They don't want to tell us theirs because then it's easier for it to get to the government and so on and so forth and get to the enemy. But in addition to that, he said, this is not our problem. Our problem is what we're trying to solve before, from the time that this is announced until we close the deal, is we don't want more than 10% of our assets to be stolen by our own employees. So we expect it to be, we know it'll be at least 10%. We're hoping to keep it under 20%. And that was the surest sign to me that the kleptocracy that the Soviet Union has been called, and that when I was there in 1973 as well as a student, and everybody who did little jobs on the side. They all stole from, you know, whatever, if say they painted people's apartments. They stole all the paint and all the equipment from the government facility that they worked for. So they had no cost in running their businesses. And, of course, it was because they got paid low. You know, there's a whole bunch of adjustments. It's the incentives in the system. They're not bad people at all. They just, the incentives were just terrible. So that's, there's one question right here. I'll come right back.
Hi. One of the things I'm very concerned about is with our corporate-controlled media, we're not getting things out about what has happened in the past. And I remember when David Stockman, who was the budget director for Ronald Reagan...
Tried to teach him.
And...
Couldn't do it.
He put out this information that the Republicans had decided that they could not get rid of Social Security and Medicare by popular vote because they were so popular with the people. And that they decided to do was the alternative of piling up so much debt on the American people that we would have to finally say we cannot afford it. And then they started doing things like having wars without accounting for it, giving prescription drug benefits without accounting for any way to pay for it, and all these ways of just mounting debt upon us. And they have done that for 30 years, and now this is what they're trying to do by, you know, saying that this, we have so much debt that we can't have Social Security and Medicare.
I would argue that this is, first off, thank you so much, and I completely agree. But I would like to say that, you know, I think that those seeming debts are very much like the reasons that, you know, the Wisconsin governor was giving for why the unions needed to be shut down. First, he had a tremendous amount of money that he gave away in tax credits to businesses in his state, and then turned around and said, "We're broke. We have." You know, the reason that that the last, you know, 25 years of presidencies has, well, it's not, since Clinton, the reason that we've gone into such tremendous debt isn't that we didn't have the money. We just moved it into the hands of individuals who have a tremendous amount of money. We weren't looking closely at how that was done. It was all sleight of hand, and we don't have people in Congress, because we don't own them anymore, who are willing to take a look at it and get the money back for us. The banking institutions give enormous amounts of money to Congress, but of course this is true for all the corporations that aren't serving us. I mean, all the parts of government that aren't serving us anymore. Was the gentleman over here?
I think part of the reason that capitalism tends to sort of work is that it encourages the development of better means of production. And once you own the fantastic sandwich making machine, it's really easy to hoard all the sandwiches.
Right.
We have an incredible amount of technology and information that's available to anyone via the internet and university libraries and all sorts of things like that. But I don't see a lot of people actually going out there and using it and having a desire to create their own means of production. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts about, instead of restricting people's ability to acquire wealth, just sort of changing what they want to do with their time.
Well, part of what I would like to say about what you were just saying is that the system is sort of rigged right now. Has anybody tried to start a small business in this room? Okay. Were banks eager to give you lots of seed money to start your business? No. Well, because you're not already a billionaire. So that's part of the problem. That didn't used to be true. 100 years ago, I mean, people who are much older in this room will actually remember a time when if you wanted to start a small business, you could go to a local banking institution, and they were very likely to give you money if you had some reasonable background to get you started. But more and more, we're seeing, you know, corporatization means that larger and larger amounts of money are being gathered up in smaller and smaller numbers of places, and you and I can't get a start.
I'd just like to remind our audience that we're listening to Matt Cantor speak at the Commonwealth Club. And more questions.
Hi.
Yes.
I was wondering if Congress, if we could have job descriptions for people in Congress involved more than being like a lawyer or somebody that's wealthy in the community. And the other thing is it possible, do you think, or how can we have Congress people recuse themselves from any issue or law that they're making or that has benefit to people who contribute more than $1,000 to their campaign.
Well, that's what happens in heaven, I think. But, you know, it's not happening here. We've slid so far against this that, I mean, we really don't have – your vote and mine doesn't mean – very much at all to people in Congress, unless we are very, very actively and very, very loudly protesting. That still does work, but people don't do it. We're all so full of McDonald's and TV, most of us aren't bothering to do that stuff. But the Egyptians proved it can happen. That's why I really cheer that. We really need to look to what they did. That was an oppressive government that nobody thought could be overturned, and it happened peacefully. Facebook and cell phones allowed people to gather together, and they sat down and they said, no, we're not going home until things change. And more poured in until suddenly there was this critical mass when people began to realize, oh, my God, they're not going to go along with this anymore. We could do that.
Hi. You mentioned earlier about the happiness index.
Yeah.
I'm just curious when they started monitoring it and what the trend has been for America. Has that index been going? Have we been ranking lower happiness, higher?
I think I looked at 2 years' worth, and I think they've been gathering it for about 10. Give me your email address, and I'll be happy to send you more information about that, and I'll take a look further back. Or you know, you can Google them, too. So
and
start on Wikipedia. You'll find a whole page on Global Happiness Index.
And the reason why I ask, too, is because of the trend of happiness. I'm curious about our banking system when we kind of became more with the development of the Federal Reserve. Has that changed, you know, the happiness index?
I think it's too new to be able to address something like that. But it's a great question. You know, go to your university and ask to do a research study on this. Develop some metrics of happiness. Look at it globally and by state and track it with the financial and governmental changes. And I'll be happy to pay for that. I'll pay my share of that study.
Well, we have time for one or two more questions.
That's a great question. Thank you very much. It's a smart question.
Now, I just wanted to know your thoughts in the context of what you talked about. It seems to me that there's this club now. I think it's, I don't know if it's the Billionaires Club, where Bill Gates and others have gathered others. I think they're like 52 who have pledged to give half their wealth to charity, to good causes and stuff. And that just seems something unique to our period of time. I don't know that there's been that sense of generosity in previous times, and I don't know if you had a thought that you could...
You know, I can't help but think that that's just all just great show for us all to look at. And if you look at actual numbers, I mean, if you look at the volume of wealth that's held by this very, I mean, I stated probably three or four different facts about how wealth is aggregated in such small places in the world. The amount of that leaks out in charity is so tiny that I think all that's really intended to do is to have us not wanting to build guillotines and drag them out in the street and cut their heads off. They want, and also, I would like to add, again, for the older crowd here, you probably remember very high tax rates for the ultra-wealthy. It was 92% at one point. It was 92%. And in, I believe, if we look at the, I think, if we just go back to Roosevelt, I think it was about 60%. So, and those people weren't screaming about it, and they were still super wealthy paying those rates. Anyway, that's
all. The Rockefellers and the Carnegies obviously made a lot of wealth and then redistributed some of it. But one of the things I was thinking the other day, you see the Newman lemonades, you know, and all the money go to charity. And it's interesting because one of the most crucial things, I think, about social organization and trying to figure out a way that's going to work for more people in the world is how do you give people something important to do, work to do that's productive? How do you do that? What's the way to do that if somebody... make up the mind for everybody, or do you decentralize it? That's the question. And I was thinking the Newman Lemonade probably employs, you know, 95% of the money goes to the employment of people who create the lemonade, who pick the things, and only 5% of the money goes to the charitable things. And What's more valuable, the 95% that employs so many people in the work or the 5% that goes to charity? I think it's another question to look at in the whole issue. Sorry, there's time for one more question.
This one. Hi. I wrote myself a couple of notes here. The increase in inequality in the United States is certainly largely the result of changes in tax policy, right? So what do you...
I don't think you could isolate it. That alone, but that's certainly a part of it, absolutely.
Okay. I would think it's a pretty important part.
It's definitely important, but there's so many ways in which we continue to fraction the society. But go ahead.
Okay. So if that's true and other factors that we basically vote in as a democracy, do you think the major reason that so many people essentially vote against themselves is what you mentioned, the false promise that they will themselves be the next Madonna to rise to the top of the pop charts, or is it because people are so determined to vote against things like abortion and gay marriage and that sort of thing, and the economic part of it just comes along for the ride?
Well, I think if we wanted to get a really good answer, we'd probably get one from somebody who's in a PR media group who makes commercials for political campaigns, because they know all those strings and how to pull all that stuff, and they know how to put John and Sally or whatever their names on and talk about how terrible it'll be when we don't get to pick our own doctor. And there are obviously there's a fraction of the society that when they're told this enough times in commercials will actually go out and vote very much against their own interests. You know, it's part of disinformation. Deliberate disinformation is part of how we stay poor when there are people who have enormous wealth. But there's no question that the way tax laws have changed over time has played a large role.
And of all the institutional setups, you know, in history, I think the cleverest one was very cynical, and that's trying to balance off the institutions against each other so no one centralizes everything. It doesn't matter whether it's capitalism or anything, that you assume everybody is almost a thief at heart, or at least thinks of themselves as the center of the universe. And how are you going to try to keep each other in check and have a relatively social situation for civilization to move forward? I think civilization moved a little bit forward today. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Thank you, George.
We also thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio or online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.